passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Welcome, everyone, to another Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel, back after a hiatus. J.J., we're...
Technically imposed hiatus.
It was. We had a podcast that had 8 takes, but now we're not using our headsets. We are using a Blue Yeti microphone. We're very excited
about it. Unpaid plug there. We're not getting any money from it, but we are excited.
We're very excited to actually have moved into the 21st century of podcasting. We were podcasting with 20th century equipment. Equipment that was made before podcasting existed. So we're happy. We appreciate everybody sticking with us through many years of comments about the past podcast audio quality. Hope that if the audio quality is improved, as we believe it shall be, let us know and review us on iTunes and make that known. Also want to remind you that BaseballAmerica.com is your home for the 2014 Baseball America reference books. We're putting the almanac to bed very soon, especially now the major league season is over. Almanac going to bed, the directory, the prospect handbook, of course, the granddaddy of them all, the Super Register, the Great Parks calendar, all available at baseballamerica.com/store.
I have a point of contention.
The almanac is the granddaddy of them all.
The prospect handbook is the...
it's the best. It's
the sprightly youngster of the bunch. It's like actually been out the same amount of time as... No, younger than the Super Register.
I think it is. I guess it's more like the Fiesta Bowl.
Yeah.
It's the newcomer, but it's just as good or better than all the rest of them.
Right.
I can't believe I made a college football bowl game reference there, but that's where I went. Yeah. But we do, you're right,
it's
is the newest
book. It's like if TD Ameritrade was better than Rosenblatt, but it's not.
But then we won't even go there. We won't even go there.
I was trying to give it a more baseball-y vibe.
I like that idea. I like where you were trying to go with it. But we did witness the end of the World Series. That was as good a time as any for us to get out of our offices, stop talking to scouts for the handbook, and come record a podcast. JJ, I was going to throw this to you. So first off, kudos to the Boston Red Sox. Congratulations. And obviously congratulations to a lot of other organizations. St. Louis Cardinals, Oakland Athletics, Pittsburgh Pirates. A lot of organizations had great years. But JJ, it was the end of an era in Major League Baseball. Tim McCarver signing off, retiring. I enjoyed Ken Rosenthal's ode to Tim McCarver. And I thought it was really important for someone like Kenny, who obviously works with him at Fox Sports, to help us put McCarver in some context beyond the grandfather that I think a lot of us were tired of and were ready to see exit the stage. But he had a graceful exit himself. Who would you like to see? But he's been the voice of Major League Baseball in the World Series for about 20 years, maybe more. Who would you like to see replace Tim McCarver in that role?
I think it's a stretch to say Pedro. After his TBS, that's probably a stretch to say that Pedro's ready for that job, but...
Waka, waka, waka. He certainly enjoyed that. Pedro has some... There's some attraction there, but I don't think he's ready quite for prime time.
No, and especially not, like, that's a different role. Studio, and that's a different role. Because the interesting thing is...
There's not a natural guy.
There's not a natural guy, and I think a lot of that is that... That's how the game has changed. If you went back... just a few years, every team had their guy. I mean, they had a guy or a couple of guys who were long time known tied to that team. That doesn't happen anymore. And I think that's more about how the game is now. And you're listening to on MLB.com, which is a lot different than you're driving, somewhere. You're listening to your team now. It's not something where if you have a team, you can listen to them all the time now, much easier than it was when it was, okay, I'm driving now, so who am I going to listen to tonight? And I'm going to listen to Ernie Harwell because I can get the Tigers game on the radio. I'm going to listen to, Vin Scully is to me, is he the last of those guys?
He's the last one who's been there for 30, 40 years. I do think every team still has people who are identified. I mean, if you think of the Braves, I still think people think of like Joe Simpson and Chip Carey, those guys who've done their broadcast for a long time. But yeah, they're not right, but they're not people who are there for 30 or 40 years anymore. There has been a generational change. It did when you and I were in college, unfortunately, 20 years ago. Every team did seem to have an Ernie Harwell or who Dave Newhouse,
Harry
whoever,
Carey.
Right, who had been there for a very long time, and we definitely there hasn't been distance between them. But yeah, like Bob Uecker, I guess, is the other guy who's been there for a long time. But when you also think of like ex players who are prominent broadcasters, most of them are more prominent for what they've done in the studio.
That's
so if you're thinking about like say ESPN, for example, Oral Hershiser has become their main color analyst. He's only been in that role for a couple of years.
And I do think that was the guy who came to my mind because I like pitchers in that role. Generally, I think they make very good color analysts because as a hitter, you got stories and all that. But the reality of it is that unless you're a catcher, there's a lot of positions where you're a little less, you're involved in your thing more, whereas a pitcher, you kind of, I think you pick up some things that are interesting, are more interesting to share.
You have more time to watch the game. Mm-hmm. You watch more as a pitcher than you do as a hitter. I think that's one part of it. I also think the other part of it, and I tend to agree with you, is that maybe the pitchers can discuss the game more. Also, it goes back to how we would like to talk about evaluating prospects. There's more to it with pitching. There is more subtlety and things, that adjustments that can be made, whereas hitters either hit or you don't. Either have that natural timing or you don't. I think the same thing is true with that truity. That what's the word I'm looking for? Not a truity. That's not a word. But that maxim carries over to the broadcaster.
Along those lines, kind of tying it to the prospects. If a guy hits 220 3 years in a row,
he's a 220 hitter.
He's a 220 hitter. You know, in the minors. If he hits 220 in the minors, that guy's not going to become a solid big leaguer. Whereas with pitchers, a guy could have a 5 ERA, and then go, oh, new grip.
Exactly.
Hi, I'm now a pitching prospect.
Exactly.
That doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen with hitters. So I do think if I had to pick a pitcher, I think I would actually lean toward Ron Darling over Hershiser. I prefer Darling, but that's another guy in the same genre. They're two sides really of the same coin. But I will throw out an X factor, and it's not because of his hair, and it's not because of his not because of anything else. I didn't go to Penn State, but I would say Tom Verducci is my Huckleberry. I would go Tom Verducci. The only color analysis I've seen Verducci do, a couple of Fox games this year. I've seen him do a couple of MLB Network games. And, of course, he did the Fall League last year. I think the combination of his contacts in the game, his knowledge of the game, his respect for the game, and just the fact that he would attack that with some real passion. I wouldn't take it for granted. There's too many times where I think the ex-player doesn't do the preparation as a color analyst because they can rely on, here's what happened when I played. I think that would make Verducci the choice, and that would be the guy that I would want to see. But I don't.
That's an interesting.
I'm glad. That's why I asked the question, because I thought I had an interesting answer.
You have an interesting answer. I did not, have an interesting answer. I had a stock, generic answer.
No, you did, but I think Oral Hershiser and Ron Darling are the most likely candidates. I'll tell you, the one that I fear the most is Kevin Millar. I really fear
The style approach.
And Kevin Millar has substance. He played at Lamar, indie baller, best indie baller ever. Indie ball ever, Kevin Millar. But there's certainly the frosted tips and the affliction t-shirts and all that kind of stuff has trumped the substance that is actually there. So he has contact. When you play at Lamar, in the era that he did, I just wrote about Dane Johnson. That was the pitching coach when Kevin Millar was there. And so he has contacts throughout the game, obviously played. It might work, but my guess is it would not work for the majority of intelligent fans. So I think there's a danger that Kevin Millar becomes the voice of baseball. And I do think it's important. You think about for basketball, for whatever positive or negative, it was Marv Albert for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was a positive for a lot of people to have Marv Albert. Yeah. And then when NBC had it and Albert had his troubles, it was Bob Costas. And the voice of the NFL, clearly, Al Michaels and John Madden and Summerall, it matters a lot more to football. But the Madden brand, I think, helped football. And I think it matters for baseball.
I think so too, from the standpoint of and this is going to take a couple of years, but there is a certain thing that when you hear certain voices, it tells you this is important.
Right, it's a cue, absolutely. To me, I'm not sure there's a natural player. Like in Fox right now, if they continue to have the World Series for the foreseeable future, their number two guy is Eric Karros. I mean, I think Eric Karros is Greek-American, so I'll give him a pass. But, I mean, really, I don't think Eric Karros should be the voice of baseball for some people. And I don't think it should be Joe Buck either, because I think Joe Buck, while he was better at baseball this year, I feel that his passion lies in the NFL. And I don't blame him. It's understandable. I don't dislike Joe Buck, but I'm just saying I think baseball needs a strong color analyst who is the national guy all the time. And you hear the World Series, you want to hear what he has to say. And that's going to be a challenge. McCarver has filled that role for so long.
This brings up an interesting point, though. What's difficult for baseball to develop this also is that baseball is a much more regional sport.
It has become that, absolutely, in terms of the media, no doubt. And
the thing about this is, I don't think necessarily that's a bad thing. Like, it gets thrown around as like that this is some awful thing that baseball... The reality is that even when baseball... Like, I don't want to go back to when baseball was a national sport and you got all excited because there's a Monday night baseball game and then you got the Saturday game of the week.
Right.
And other than that, you would never see any of these teams ever, otherwise. I love the fact that I can watch any team I want any night. But what that mainly means... We're baseball omnivores. We want to watch every team. Most people, understandably, what's great about that is that I can watch my team,
right,
or I can listen to my team's broadcast wherever I am, anywhere in the country, every night. It means that baseball has become more regional, but that's taking advantage, or whatever you want to call it, of the current of the internet era.
Yeah, as Pearl Jam would say, it's evolution, baby. I don't think it's negative. Evolution isn't... Evolution, for those of you who believe in it, isn't always in the positive direction. It's not positive. It's not negative. It just is. And this has been the evolution. That's where
baseball,
the money is. And that's
baseball
the way
plays
going.
162 games.
It can't be a national
for every
event.
Team. There's not going to be some point where we're going to get all excited because, hey, they're on the Fox game this week.
Right.
The reality of it is that we're giant baseball fans. I don't ever go, ooh, who's on the Fox game this week on Saturday? Because I'm watching baseball Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night. Actually, to be honest with you, the thing that's frustrating is, that means I can't watch any other games because they're blacked out on MLB.com.
See, I will say it is different with little kids because I had my son stay up with me to watch some of the World Series games, but he never made it to the end. And you could see he'd start nodding off, just getting tired at 9:15.
I didn't make it through every game.
Right. But so, like, last night, game six, he wanted to stay up, but, like, 9:15... Maybe it was even a little bit later than that. He saw Stephen Drew's home run, and he thought, well, the Red Sox are going to win this game. I'm going to sleep. And I just said to him, are you sure? I'll let you stay up a little longer. He goes, yeah, the problem with Major League Baseball games, Dad, is that they just go too long. And this is a guy who went to the College World Series this year. And sat through
John's son is a huge baseball fan. But it is – the reality of this is that – and I don't – this is just the nature of the game. There are times in key innings in the World Series where you are talking, it is 30 seconds a pitch.
Yeah, when you're watching on DVR, as he does in the morning, I'm telling him, fast forward, hit the 30-second button where you can
and
skip ahead.
And
you don't miss a pitch.
And that's something I do think that really, if you ask what is where pitching changes, I think that there. I'm not one of those dyed-in-the-wool traditionalists who says no. The way that we do pitching changes in baseball now isn't traditional. That wasn't the case. It's not something where you go, that's what it was like in 1950. You could in 1950. No one did. That's something where the game's evolved, and maybe you want to say, you know what? Maybe it is that you're allowed one time in a game to change pitcher in the middle of an inning where you have not allowed a run yet.
Right.
I don't think that would cause the game irreparable harm, but that's not the bigger... The bigger issue, if you want to speed up the pace of the game, is that... And I don't blame pitchers or hitters. It's the game they've been taught to play. But the game that everyone's been taught to play now is, pitch happens. I step out. I think of what I want to do. I visualize what I'm going to do on this next pitch. Okay, now I step back in. And we saw it in this. Uh-oh, the pitcher's in a rhythm. I'm going to step back out because I'm going to try to get him out of his rhythm.
And that's part of the game. But it's very difficult for umpires, I think, to regulate that. And so that has to come from the commissioner's office. It has to come from the top.
It has to come from throw a pitch with him stepping out of the plate.
That's obviously a bigger change that's going on in baseball in 2014 will be who replaces Bud Selig. But I thought the Tim McCarver thing was kind of an interesting jumping off point of talking about with the World Series. But with the World Series over, it is prospect season. And prospect season kind of starts, you know, with our league top 20s. Then, JJ, we have draft report cards. This was your – I think we're too far removed from league top 20s. We could talk about them, but
– Byron Buxton is still good.
Exactly. But draft report cards, as we start – we've already had top 10s with Miami and Atlanta. But draft report cards, this was your first time doing draft report cards. And it's fun. It's one of our fun assignments, is it not?
It is. I want to do more next year.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it really was fun because it is a great way to kind of just look at the draft. And we do a variety of categories, mainly partly to just kind of make sure that we are kind of covering the full gamut. You know, in a lot of cases, if you're reading, you know, our stuff, you know that the first round, a lot about the first round pick.
Yep.
But this is an opportunity to tell you a little bit more about the first round pick, but also to tell you, by the way, that 18th round pick, that guy could really run.
Right.
You know, you get later round picks, and a lot of times it's, this guy has a really interesting tool. Now, there's a lot of other tools that have to come together, but, you know, hey, the Brewers guy.
Yeah, Johnny Davis.
Johnny Davis. Draft report cards was great when we were talking about, you know, like, Johnny Davis, like, wow, this guy is fascinating.
He is fascinating, and Johnny Davis is a junior college player whom the Brewers drafted, I believe, in the 22nd round. I forget which Los Angeles junior college it was because he went to four. And he started off at L.A. Trade
Tech. There are causes for concern anytime you say the words, when he played at his four junior colleges.
Yes, but that's, I think the guy I talked to the most about Johnny Davis, and I think this will dispel some misconceptions. Draft report cards don't have to just be what we're spoon-fed from the team. Mm-hmm. I usually wind up chasing down secondary sources mm-hmm. after I talk to the scouting director. And in the Brewers' case, it happened to be Johnny Davis's junior college coach. Because when the Brewers told me that Johnny Davis ran a 6.60, I called BS on that.
Yes.
Period. I just did. I asked in a follow-up, really? 6.00? And they were like, yeah, 6.00. I don't believe it.
I've never been told by anyone that they got a guy at 6.00.
Yeah, me neither. That's
like hearing a 1.6 pop or a...
Right. The fastest I heard...
It was 3.1 to first.
Yeah, the fastest I ever heard was a 6.1 from Marcus Nettles at the University of Miami. I was told that Miami had a scout day, University of Miami, 2001, team that ended up winning the national championship, but that Mike Rodriguez, an outfielder, ran a 6.3 and that Marcus Nettles ran a 6.1.
And John Manuel's love affair with Marcus Nettles began.
That's right. That's true. But I did not believe the 6.1. But anyway, that's the fastest I ever heard. Johnny Davis 6.00. So I call his junior college coach, who happens to have been a bird dog for the Dodgers and threw batting practice for the Dodgers, helped run the Dodgers workout pre-draft in 2009 when they worked out Billy Hamilton. They didn't draft him, they worked him out. So he comps Johnny Davis to Billy Hamilton for speed and Ricky Henderson for a body comp. I mean, look, the guy's 23 years old. He went to four different JCs. But he said, yeah, I mean, he ran 10.4, 10.5 over 100 meters. So I can buy 6.60. And he ran track at LA Trade Tech, which is, you know, one of these rare track programs that are in the country. So he said, look, I never timed him myself, but that does not surprise me. That's believable.
A 10.400 is not world class, but you're not far off from it.
You're not. You're half a second back, which in the world of 100 meters is a chasm.
Right. You would be the Estonia runner, you know, in the first heat, you know, but
I was going to say Greek, but yeah, sure. But yeah, 10.4, 10.5 seconds. I can see that being a 6 second flat burst or 6 and change.
So, yeah, I would say it's more like, you know, it's more likely it's...
Now, that's probably running track. But, I mean, the point is the guy's an 80 runner. And if he makes it, he could be that one off the scale, that 0.3% runner. So, Johnny Davis, 23 years old, at a junior college. You know, he did hit .290 in the Arizona League. Guy played very little high school baseball. But those are the stories that come out of draft report cards that are really the neat ones. Or that's a little tidbits, like, okay, the Braves took Jason Hirsch out of Oklahoma State. You know, Jason Hirsch was a consensus guy, but I didn't know that the Braves had really followed Jason Hirsch significantly in high school in the Dallas area. Worked him out, really wanted him, early in the 2010 draft. Didn't think he was signable. The Pirates knew the signability was difficult, drafted him anyway, one of three unsigned picks they had in the first 10 rounds that year. Didn't get Jason Hirsch. Braves get him 3 years later. there, and he's kind of a entree, JJ, to talk a little bit about the draft report cards and the Braves, because the Braves are fascinating. The way they keep on drafting and developing, you had this as an SBA question, they keep finding fresh arms and low-mileage players. It's hard to call Jason Hurts a fresh arm who's had Tommy John surgery, but he is.
Surgically reconstructed arm is fresh.
It is very fresh. But they seem to be...
Six years plus left before the next...
At least 7 years. But they find players in out-of-the-way places that other teams aren't finding as consistently.
I think that you said, where are the Braves' success come from right now? I mean, there's really a couple of points. One is, you draft... You know, they did draft Jason Hayward, Freddie Freeman, same draft. That's pretty key.
Good draft.
I mean, that's key because... You have these two cornerstone guys that they needed. They had to have someone basically to come in and take over as Chipper. And now Brian McCann likely gone.
Right.
Those guys do that. But beyond that, they've really, I think more than anything, I think the Braves scout junior colleges better. I'm not going to say as well as the cop-out way. I do think they scout them better than anyone else.
They scout them more, and they scout them better. And it started with Roy Clark, and it's continued under Tony DiMaggio. When the draft and follow rules were going on, they were a draft and follow team, very heavy.
Tommy Hansen's
from the second to last class of draft and follows. Cole Rohrbaugh was one of my cheese balls from the last class of draft and follows. He didn't work out. I love Cole Rohrbaugh. But the Braves have continued that. I remember talking to Roy about them centering on JUCO players, and he just was very upfront about it. High school players, for the most part, were pricing themselves out of the Braves' range. The Braves didn't want to spend that kind of money in the draft on high school players, and junior college players were more signable, and they've had success with it, whether it's Craig Kimbrell, Chris Medlin, Andrelton Simmons. On down the line, Brandon Beachy's another, not a JUCO guy, but an NDFA.
Non-traditional.
Wes Parsons now an NDFA, who's a prospect. Vic Caratini. It really is. The run here is pretty good. Vic Caratini's in their top 10 this year out of Miami-Dade. JC, it's a pretty nice run, JJ. And there really isn't another club in the same area code as far as scouting junior colleges as having.
And I think that's been key for them, because the reality of it is that when they've gotten into more trouble is when they've gone kind of the more traditional route. They've had some guys work out, but, Sean Gilmartin, that doesn't look very good for them.
It doesn't.
I mean, they've had a number of picks who you look, okay, that guy just didn't pan out. But
and the Braves fans like to remind us of that. They're not sanguine on Tony DiMaggio. I can see why, because there have been some first-round picks that have been underwhelming. The Gilmartin one is the one that sticks out.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Andrelton Simmons, if I remember right, that was Tony's. That was Tony's draft. That makes up for busting a first-round pick.
I think so. Even if you just drafted him as a shortstop, said okay, we're going to let him play shortstop because we really want to convert him to pitcher. I don't care either. Sometimes
you drafted a player who is an impact shortstop.
I'm with you.
Like, talk about cornerstone guys. He's another cornerstone guy for them. I don't care if you want to say, well, they lucked into it. They thought he was going to be a pitcher. They drafted him. They played him at shortstop, and he's a gold glove shortstop now.
Just looking at that Braves 2007 draft, by the way, they drafted Craig Kimbrell that year, did not sign him. 33rd round, they drafted him and didn't sign him. And there was one other. Oh, and then Brandon Belt. I'm actually glad the Braves didn't sign Brandon Belt, because I can't imagine. So even if you just drafted him as a shortstop, said okay, we're going to let him play shortstop because we really want to convert him to pitcher. I don't care either. Sometimes
you drafted a player,
but JJ, the Braves.
I think the best way to put it with the Braves is the Braves' top 10 is better than either of us thought it was when we started. Thinking about the Braves' top 10.
Right. It was. And there are a couple of intriguing guys in that top 10. Let's start with Tommy La Stella. Tommy La Stella is a guy we wrote about a lot in college. He was a key player at Coastal Carolina. And Coastal Carolina, I believe it was La Stella's junior year in 2010. One of those years, they were loaded and won 50-some games. And remember, had an epic super regional against South Carolina when South Carolina went on to win the national championship.
And they were the one who gave them probably the best challenge.
Let's think, back-to-back years, South Carolina's super regionals were really tough because they also had UConn the other year, the George Springer. They didn't have Mike Gold, but it was Springer, Ahmed, Matt Barnes, UConn, Kevin Vance, LJ Mazzilli, very good UConn team. But Coastal Carolina was also outstanding. Rico Newell, the left-hander Cody Wheeler, who's the hard-throwing right-hander they had. Anthony Mayo, I think, was on that team. But I think LaStella was on that team, too. So that was, you know, kind of their year. That was their one big year, JJ. And Tom LaStella's in the middle of that. And just talking to a scout today who's seen him in the Arizona Fall League, I think Peter Gammons was the one who tweeted out a Matt Carpenter comparison. And I don't think he's as athletic as Matt Carpenter. But if you're going to put a 6 or 7 hit on LaStella and a lot of other 4 tools, this scout didn't blink at that.
I had a scout tell me this week, you know, that he's as good as any hitter he saw this year in the minors.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Now, that's hit tool. I mean, that's not like he's the best prospect he's seen this year. This guy saw Buxton. Buxton's a better prospect.
Right.
Just a touch.
But, I mean, he's a hard guy to rank because you want to rank a guy like that aggressively. I think having him in the top 10 when he's never played a full season, so there's some injury issues and durability issues, kind of what the ceiling really is for this guy. I think more likely he's a 6 hitter. But he does control the strike zone awfully well.
325 career hitter.
Right. And I think, the caveat to me with that is you don't ever have time to get cold if you're playing 80 games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do worry about that durability. I think it's a little bit, you know, he has smaller sample sizes.
And I do also worry, my big worry with LaStella, it all comes back to when you ask anyone who raves about his hit tool, then you follow that up and you say, so what do you think about him defensively?
Right.
And it comes back to, the best you get is, I think he can do it.
Right, exactly.
And the answer of, I think he can do it, translates as, okay, so yes, he's not exactly what you're looking for at second base, but second base is a position where if you hit and knock the ball down and you throw it to first, you'll probably be okay.
When your comparison point is going to be Dan Uggla, he might look great in comparison to Dan Uggla. But
well, I'll put it this way. I feel very confident that if you put Tommy LaStella in the big leagues next year and he made it through 150 games, he's going to have a higher average than Ned Uggla did this year.
I
feel
that's
extremely
fair.
Confident on that.
I'm with you on that one. But to me, that top 6 of the Braves was pretty set. Sims, Betancourt, Graham. I think Graham would have been number 1 had he been healthy, but a small-bodied guy.
Yeah, I worry. Graham's one of those guys. I always worry about the guy who there's no good way to rank a guy who you don't know an answer on his health going into next year.
Right.
There's no good way to rank him.
Because he threw in instructional league, but he didn't pitch a game in instructional league. He threw off flat ground. He threw off the mound. They wanted to get him into a game, but they couldn't. He wasn't back up to full strength enough to get him into an instructional league game. That wasn't a great sign.
Right. And because the problem with ranking that guy is you rank. If you rank him entirely on what he did before, then you put him, okay, then he is number 1 on this
right.
list. At the same time, if you say completely, you can't say on the other end, hey, we're not going to really rank this guy anywhere because we don't know what his stuff's going to look like. Well, you can't do that either. So you have to kind of split the difference and just kind of try to do that and say, okay, well, you know, here's a best guess. Adding in some risk for the injury, but at the same time saying, okay, we're going to rank you still pretty high because if healthy, he's number 1 on this list.
He's a very difficult guy to come up with a ranking for because he was almost number 1 on this list last year, you know, after Julio Teheran's really iffy season,
season. But to talk about it, pure healthy, a healthy J.R. Graham, comparing him to Lucas Sims, in Graham's case, don't know what his stuff's going to look like. Well, you can't do that either. So you have to kind of split the difference and just kind of try to do
harder throwing Chris Medlin. Everything, he does all the good things that Medlin does, athleticism, repeats his delivery, keeps the ball down, works the bottom third of the bottom of the zone, but he does it with pitches that grade out a grade or 2 better than Chris Medlin. And Chris Medlin, although he wasn't as good this year, has been pretty good the last couple of years. So I always like that comp within the Braves own organization, but it's not the deepest Braves top 30. But
I think once you get to, you get to that 10 to 15 range and you start getting a little.
I don't think it was as bad as we thought it would be.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
We've talked about this in the office. We talk about BA grades for the prospect handbook a lot.
Yes.
And one of the things that really, I kind of feel like that is your, when you get your prospect handbook, and we assume that if you listen to this, it's well worth your while to get one. When you get it, look at with the team that you're looking at, where the 50 highs start.
Right.
The 50 highs right. is the point that you get to where you say, okay, not that this the guy who ranks 12th at 50 high and the guy who ranks 26th, who may also be a 50 high, are an absolutely, you know, the same thing. They're not. But it is a sign of where you go from the guys who are high, you are kind of more the slam dunk guys, to the guys who a 50 high is generally going to be either a guy who was just drafted and hadn't had a chance yet to have his flaws shown,
right?
Or the guys who have a lower ceiling at the upper levels.
That's fair. And a lot of draft guys who get that 50 high, like you said, and it's almost like a default. You know, LaStella was a tougher guy to rank. The Braves, that's one thing. The Braves had a lot of tough guys to grade. A lot of guys who didn't fit neatly into the grades and the profiles because they're tough profiles. They had a lot more risk. And that also happens with a lot of low Class A players. The Braves had a lot of players off their own team who wound up in their top 10. And
I mean, like,
their top
even
30.
Like Jose Peraza, who's in their top right. 10. Like, Jose Peraza is a guy, okay, you can throw, you know, we haven't set these grades, but you can throw a 55 on him if you... If he's going to be a shortstop who's a top-of-the-order hitter,
right.
that could be a 55. But at the same time, a guy in low A who, despite all the steals, he's not an eight runner or you know
right.
anything. Like, you could end up, even with a guy like him, saying that's more of a 50.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see some of their grades. And the same thing with the Marlins, because the Marlins, JJ, graduated so many of their really high-grade players to the major leagues. And we don't have a handbook handy, but... Jose Fernandez got a pretty sick grade, if memory serves, last
yes,
year.
And well-deserved.
Because what was he, like number 5 on the top 100, number 6?
Yeah.
It was high. I know we had him jacked up and probably could have had him jacked up even more considering how good he was this year. That's an organization that really graduated a lot of talent. Now, I did their draft report card this year, and this was a case, and there's one specific prospect in here who I want to talk about, and that's Zach Cox. You know, Zach Cox, perfect example of why the Cardinals are a good organization. They draft him in the first round. They flipped him basically as soon as they possibly could. A year and a half later, essentially, he's flipped to the Marlins.
You can't flip him quicker than a year. That's the first day you can... 1 year and a day is the first day that you can trade a draft pick.
And he's nowhere to be seen in the Marlins' top 10, and not on their 40-man roster, outright up
not,
the 40-man
yeah, I was
roster.
Say, not only not on their 40-man roster... was dumped from their 40-man roster, and every other team out there said, nah, pass.
Yep, everybody said, no thank you. And this year they took Colin Moran in the first round. Colin Moran's a different side of that Zach Cox coin, where Zach Cox's track record in college was arm strength, not a lot of... The defensive scouting report was actually similar. Limited mobility, even though Moran's much bigger than Cox. Cox is like 6 feet tall. Collins probably 6'3", 6'4". But Colin Moran, limited mobility, but they both had good arm strength. You know, can both play third base. Neither one's going to be a gold glover. With Moran, it's the hit tool over power. With Cox, it was either hit for power in college or he hit for average. He did not show the ability to do both at the same time. So really curious. So it's a case of, I think, the Marlins taking... Moran was probably one of the safest players in the draft, but I think he's a better version of Zach Cox, but I think it's kind of similar, and he was really drafted in a lot of ways to fill an organizational need. When you have Ed Lucas at third base in the big leagues, and you don't have anything else in your organization, you've traded Matt Dominguez for Carlos Lee.
And Moran should move quickly.
He should.
That being said, no, I do think, I follow where you're going on that. The big thing to me is I have a lot more belief that Moran is going to hit for some average with some power.
Yes.
I think the question with Moran really comes down to how much impact he's going to have.
Yep.
Zach Cox, I mean, we had these discussions in the office. You know, there was a relatively strong belief among some that, you know, that Zach Cox wasn't going to ever have any impact.
Yeah, and it's really strange that the industry really liked Zach Cox. It wasn't just the Cardinals. The industry liked that guy, and they liked him out of high school. I think it was a 6th-round pick out of high school. It's just surprising how far south his bat went so quickly. But the Marlins are kind of the ones who get left holding the bag there. So they had a first-round pick at third base in 2007 in Dominguez. had a 2010 first-round pick in Cox that they traded for in 2012. And now in 2013, because of organization need, they had to go out and draft Moran. I shouldn't say had to, but
no, I was going to say, it's not like that was, but it wasn't, when you say organization need, though.
It was one of their concerns. That's what comes up in the draft report.
I'm not saying it wasn't one of their concerns. At the same time, though, this isn't like they forced a pick. Like,
correct. Right. That's correct.
That, to me, because when I hear organizational need, like, I do think that any team with the major league, with the baseball draft, because of you're talking a couple years out, any team that drafts and says, well, we've got this guy this on our board, and we got this guy this, but we need a center fielder.
It happens in every draft. I mean, when an NBA player is not a first-round talent, but you draft them because you need a big man, that doesn't work out. Doesn't that work out the same in the NFL? Usually you're the NFL expert here, but,
right, but I'm saying,
if there's a quarterback who's not a true first-round talent, but he gets forced into the first round because of the dearth of quarterbacks,
that absolutely happens.
Doesn't work out.
I do think, though, the big difference in baseball and where you really get into much more trouble when you do that is, the best way I can put it is that the Red Sox a year ago looked like they had holes in a lot of places.
Right.
And now they're the best team in baseball.
And they drafted Trey Ball this year.
Right. And it's not because of the draft. In football, when you say, well, we've got to put a quarterback out there next year. I follow that. Or in NBA, we don't have a center. We're going to force this pick at center because, you know what? We don't have one. In baseball, none of these guys we're talking about, if you don't have a third baseman, and you say, we're going to draft this guy even though, and again, they didn't do that in this case, but you draft a guy and say, even though we have this guy fifth on our board at this spot, we're going to take him because we need the position.
Right.
You run into much more trouble because even if that guy's decent, you're saying, okay, we know that 3 years from now or 2 years from now, even at the speediest, 5 years from now, we're going to need a third baseman. And you can't predict that.
I feel like the NBA draft has actually trended toward the baseball draft as they've drafted younger and younger and European and whatever. Well, so it's really more of a best player available draft in the NBA now than it ever used to be. Is that happening at all in football when you have...
No, because in football, the problem in football is that for after you get past the first round, these guys hit restricted free agency in like year four. So if you're drafting a guy, you know, like developmentally, by the time you develop him, he's going to cost you a lot of money. So there's a lot of incentive not to do that.
All the incentive in the NFL is for colleges to develop their players for them.
Right. It is. But you look at going, you know, in baseball, though, I think we've also seen examples of it. Now, I'm interested to see what's happening now, because we really do have now with a lot of teams, the Tigers at first base, the Angels at first base, the Reds at first base.
Yes.
We have a number of teams who have essentially blocked off the position that you have for, you know, the landing place for the guy who can hit, but who's questionable defensively. And essentially especially in the Reds case, they've taken that position. That position is out of play.
For the next decade?
For the next decade. Like, and what's interesting about this is that, but you still see the Reds still, when they had Joey Votto, drafted Yonder Alonso, with the idea being, take the guy who you like at that position. We can always, if he develops, as we expect, you can always turn around. That turned into Matt Latos. But it is interesting to see, because we haven't seen that before nearly as much. It's one thing when the Rangers sign A-Rod to a 10-year deal. He's a shortstop.
Right.
If you draft a shortstop, it's never like you say, oh, we don't know what we can do with this guy. He can only play shortstop.
Right, yeah, the Red Sox did that with when Nomar Garciaparra was the 1997 Rookie of the Year, 1998 first round, Adam Everett.
Right, it's like we can figure that, we can always work out. You know, that's not a problem. But first base, I'm doing the Reds list right now. In another organization, you might say with Jesse Winker, well, that guy could end up at first base. Derek Lutz, not Derek Lutz.
Donald Lutz.
Derek Lutz was a pitcher for them.
Browner Hulk.
Yeah, but Donald Lutz, in another organization, Donald Lutz would not be saying, work on your outfield play.
Yeah.
In that organization, you say it because...
Oh, remember Brian Howard in the minor leagues? I just love going back and reading the old ones that Brian Howard develops. They had already signed Jim Thome as a free agent. Hey, Ryan Howard, try playing left field. Can you imagine that these days with the way things have worked out for Ryan Howard? Ryan Howard in left field, that had to be amusing, to say the least. Yeah.
But that's the thing about it is that you have these teams where...
Hey, how about Yonder Alonso playing third base? That happened in the major leagues, didn't it?
Having never played it in the minors.
Yeah, Alan Craig at second base is one of my other favorite ones. The Cardinals did that.
But it is one of those things that, like, it would be interesting to see. But even with that, it still makes sense. If the guy's highest on your board, draft that guy first round. I understand. You're going to draft for need in the sixth round because... The reality is that, okay, well, you know what? We don't have a shortstop for our low A team. We need a shortstop. Okay, draft a college shortstop. But first round, I don't think it ever pays to say, hey, we need that position.
I do think after the first round, a lot of teams do have, it's my experience has been where they go into a draft saying, okay, here's where the strength of this draft class is as we assess it, so we want to go after this. Or our organization really, we have no catchers. I know there's not a lot of catchers in this draft, but let's prioritize catchers. You know, if there's guys that we have in the third round, if we have three guys who have a third round number on them, let's do what we can to get one of those three guys.
And the interesting thing, we've seen several teams who this year did that to a crazy degree. And I think we both agree that we're not real big fans of that idea. Like the team who takes right hand, you know, takes pitchers with almost all their first 12 round picks.
Yeah, that's an unusual one. Didn't the Angels do that? Did the Angels have an extremely pitcher-heavy draft?
Blue Jays were also, if I remember correctly, very...
Although I think that it's hard to measure their draft because their top draft bonuses wound up being after the first 10 rounds. So the whole Blue Jays draft is just a... Their drafts are just different now. It's the way they're running their whole draft.
But they did that, and then, you know, we had a couple of years ago, the Pirates who went right-hander pitcher-heavy.
Yes, outside of Mel Rojas Jr. So, yeah, I mean... What else? Did anything else stand out to you in doing draft report cards? Because this year's draft class, the other thing we wrote about in the process of doing draft report cards was those debuts of the top draft picks and the Jonathan Gray, Mark Appel, Chris Bryant. And since then, JJ, we've had now Gray shut down and Appel. Neither one's pitching in the fall league,
understandably,
which it makes a lot of sense. But Jonathan Gray, pretty outrageous debut, unhittable debut, especially. He wasn't allowed to use his slider in the Pioneer League, and then the Cal
just
League
had to
was
make
like
things a little fair for the Pioneer League hitters.
In the Cal League, it wasn't a league rule; it was the Rockies' rule. Clarify that. But when
your slider's too good, we had to have it banned.
But when we got to the Cal League,
a slider is a cutter. Don't worry.
In the Cal League, they said, "Oh, you could use your slider now. I'll allow it, counselor." And the result was the 0.75 ERA and like 14 strikeouts per nine. So this guy wows. Chris Bryant wows, 0-for-5 with 5 strikeouts in his first game in the Northwest League, then basically hits safely in all but one game after that. 3 errors in his first Arizona League game, which was his first game. There was a learning curve in both places, but then just dominant. I think the Cubs guy I just talked to today said that for the year, counting college, regular season, minor league postseason, and fall league, it's 47 home runs. For Chris Bryant.
He hit, you got 31 in the college.
Yep.
You've got 9
right
in the regular season.
And now it's 7 in the fall league.
Did he hit one last night?
Yes.
Yes, so 7 in the fall league.
And there's a right center field Oppo home run that's already like, just emailing with guys in the fall league because I'm going out there next week. It's kind of like an epic, the tales of this Chris Bryant 450-foot home run to right center field that are just growing in legend in the fall.
The best way to put it is right now, I think it's fair to say when we're a long way off from the top 100.
Yes.
But there's going to be a debate whether Chris Bryant or Jonathan Gray ends up ranked higher of those two.
Correct. Those two guys are going to get shoved into the top 10.
There is no debate right now whether Mark Appel is going to be ahead of them.
Yeah, he's not going to be ahead of those guys.
No, he's not. I mean, that's just a little. Mark Appel's not going to be ahead of him on the top 100. It's not going to happen.
And he was in the Midwest League, and it just sounds like JJ. It's not that he disappointed, but he didn't wow.
He failed to wow,
I guess failing to wow is a disappointment when you go 1-1 and you've been a 2-time first round pick.
Really, if you're an Astros fan, what you're hopeful for on this is that, okay, it was a long season. Not that his season was any longer. His season was actually shorter by a week than Jonathan Gray's. But you don't want to go too overboard on a guy, you know, struggling, not even struggling, but not wowing after he's already done a full college season before he ever, you know, threw his first pitch. The reality of it is that if this was 3 years ago, he wouldn't have pitched. So we would be sitting here and just completely basing it off of what he did at Stanford.
Yeah, and an instruct.
And an instruct.
We would have been hanging on every pitch at instruct.
By the way, we will establish the rule again. The next guy who had a terrible instructs will be the first guy.
He'll be the second, because Jesus Montero had a terrible instructs.
Okay.
That's the Jesus Montero corollary. is that there's almost no one who ever has a terrible instruct. But there was one guy who got run down on an instruct.
But that being said, no, I mean, Chris Bryant, the stories on Chris Bryant get better by the day. The stories on Jonathan Gray aren't getting better because he's not doing anything right now.
Right. But they were pretty good.
They were pretty loud. They weren't so loud on Mark Appel. No one, I mean, I didn't talk to anyone who saw him in the Midwest League. And I talked to, I think, three different scouts who saw him, which, I mean, that doesn't sound like that many, but he didn't throw that many.
He threw, I think, 8 games.
Right. Three different guys, and all three are like, eh. I'm not saying no. I'm not saying not a big league or anything like that. But they're all three like, I expected more.
Yeah.
We haven't heard anyone who came back from the fall league or saw, you know, Chris Bryant in the Florida State League and went, you know, I expected more out of that guy than the mammoth show he put on for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's impressive, and it's a column I got to work on, is how did the city of Las Vegas produce 2010 draft high school class Chris Bryant? Should have been 2011 high school draft class Bryce Harper, who was actually 2010 junior college class, but we all know that story. But he was in the class of 2011. So Bryant was in the class 2010, Harper 2011, Gallo 2012. Who you got most power out of those three guys, JJ?
Gallo.
Wow. I knew you were going to go Gallo, but...
I mean, I'm not saying Harper. You know, and if you want to say Gallo or Harper, and I mean, like, and look, we're saying...
I'm going Harper, Bryant, Gallo. I am, and you were literally taken aback.
My jaw actually did drop, but you know, I guess part of it comes down. I haven't seen, you know, I don't want to give a, you know, observer bias to it, but I'm doing observer bias to it in that I've seen multiple games of Joey Gallo BP, and I've seen, you know, I can't think of who I've seen. I've watched Russ Branyan BP, which I always think of. I mean, that's a deep cut, but for all his flaws, Russ Branyan is to me one of the guys who stands out. I've seen Willie Mopena BP.
That's a deeper cut,
you know,
than Russ Branyan.
Seen Latimer Ballantyne, your Japan home run, you know, champ, you know, and these are all guys, and Gallo may fit in the same category of the guy who has, you know, when we're talking about 10 years from now, you go, the BP shows were amazing.
I'll put it this way. Anthony Iapos is the Cubs hitting coordinator. He was in the Marlins system when Giancarlo Stanton was in the Marlins, was coming up. Mm-hmm. And he was hitting coach in Jupiter when Stanton was there. And Stanton, to me, is like, I know he didn't perform this year, but just
but
raw.
Stanton is, you know.
If you're one of these scouts who believes there's only 180 and everybody else is after that.
Which we don't believe that.
I don't believe that. I think there's people off the scale. So if he's in that 0.3% outlier, I would say.
I still, one of the more fun stories I've, you know, there's a lot of fun stories I've gotten to do at BA, so great job. But one of the more fun ones was just a random thing, was a home run that Stanton hit when he was playing for AA Jacksonville and, like, was able to get, like, a good description of where the ball landed. And, like, you know, the great thing now is, again, the world we live in now.
Right.
Was able to pull it up on Google Maps with a little pedometer out and, like, okay, so it started here and it landed here. And it's like, wait, let me check that again.
Right.
Like, wait, is that right? You know, it was... Right at 500, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's the stories you get with doing the Cubs Top 30, which I'm doing for the first time this year, are Baez and Bryant, Javier Baez and Chris Bryant. Just like the can you top this? I guess the home run that Javier Baez hit against Japan in Major League Spring Training when the Japanese team was here for the WBC, that's an epic home run. That's among the epic home runs that Javier Baez has hit. My favorite Javier Baez story, I know I'm digressing here a little bit, but Javi Baez apparently hit a home run when there was catcher's interference. He hit a home run where, if you watch it on YouTube, he looks back at the catcher and the umpire and is yelling to the umpire that he didn't call catcher's interference, that he got the glove. So that's a unique one. So there's a few unique stories.
My favorite one is the game, I think he hit three. And it was
he had
like
a four.
Four, yeah. No, I wouldn't, but this was... Didn't he also, did he have a two or a three?
I think he also had a three, but I think
Cause
he
had a Because this wasn't a double A, because...
Yeah.
I hate to say, I was watching my MLB TV. It may have been two, but I was watching MLB TV. It may have been two and then another, you know, like double or triple or whatever. And it was just, I mean, it was like, by the time he came up in like the seventh inning, all the announcers were like, well, let's just see what he does here. I mean, it was...
It was like Big Poppy in the World Series. It was that kind of
locked in. By the way,
in.
that's a perfect digression to wrap this up on. We talked about this in the office a little bit. Okay.
So I'll throw it to you. Put me on the spot, I'll throw you on the spot. But not putting you on the spot because we talked about this already.
That's all right.
But greatest DH of all time.
For me, it's still Big Frank. I'd say it's Frank Thomas.
I agree.
I know that he played a lot of games at first base, but he played more games at DH or as the DH than he did as a first baseman. And I just think, you know, he's a better pure hitter than Edgar Martinez or David Ortiz. And that's saying something for Edgar Martinez, who was as pure as it comes. I know Frank Thomas, some people didn't like his swing, that old kind of Charlie Lau, Walt Reniac swing. But, I mean, why would he have changed anything? He controlled the strike zone as well as anybody. He had unbelievable power. I mean, he was like a 70 hitter with 70 power. I mean, I don't see how it... I don't see how there's a debate. I respect Dave Cameron. I respect a lot of the Mariners. There are a lot of very intelligent Mariners fans. I get the cult of Edgar Martinez. But I don't see how we forget about Frank Thomas. I really don't.
The only argument to me is if you're arguing that he's not a DH, but I don't know how you can do that, because that's the difficult thing about a DH argument, is that, so I can't see how you say, no, Frank Thomas doesn't fit the category because he played a middling first base in the first half of his career, and that disqualifies him for being this compared to a guy who played a poor third base and they pulled the plug on that quicker.
Yeah, and I mean, this the rate numbers, the OPS plus, the on base, the slugging, the total, the counting numbers, they're all in Frank Thomas's favor. I mean, they're all in his favor. So I respect, and for me, I think I would rank it Thomas, and I'm not counting Molitor. Molitor, I believe, had a plurality of
Molitor
games
played,
at DH,
yeah.
But he didn't have the majority of his Molitor games
played,
in his career.
Molitor's a position player. I mean, he played...
I think the majority of his games he played at a position, mm-hmm. But if you rank the games by position play, DH comes first. So
I do think you could make that argument. If someone wants to make the argument Molitor's the greatest DH, I still take Frank over.
I would take Frank Thomas over him still. I agree. I don't think Frank Thomas... gets a lot of, I mean, obviously he didn't play in the postseason in 2005 for the White Sox, but he was part of that team for a World Series championship team. So to me, that helps. The biggest thing that Ortiz has over the other players is his postseason heroics are obviously legendary and reality as well.
Right. and there was, it's like, you get credit for that. At the same time, I hate to penalize a guy too much for the fact that, like, you don't get to pick the team you're on.
Right. But when you're there, he did take advantage of the situation. I mean, Frank Thomas, 224, but 441, 429 in 16 playoff games. So not bad, but certainly when you're facing better pitching and you're as good, whether it's clutch or whether it's because you're good, David Ortiz deserves the credit for
that long
period of very good postseason performance.
See, he has 16 games. How many did Big Papi have this year?
I mean, close to 16.
Yeah.
five. I'm not math right now, please.
That's the other thing. It's like, I do get a little bugged by is when they say, so-and-so set a postseason record for most this or whatever. It's like...
Yeah, the apples to oranges postseason records.
You're playing a whole lot more games now than, you know, back when you're just like, okay, let's go play the World Series now. The regular season's over.
Yeah, so that it is when Tim McCarver, as we started, says David Ortiz is the best DH of all time. I do think in his Boston incarnation, that's defensible. His OPS plus is basically the same, if not a tiny bit better than Edgar Martinez's. It's the way, if I remember correctly, it was 156 for. And I know that's just one measurement.
Yeah,
it's not the only
measurement.
It was 156 for Frank Thomas.
These are DHs. We're not having to work anything else in there. It's just hitting.
Right. It was 156 for Big Frank, 148 for Big Papi, 147 for Edgar Martinez. And if you wanted to give, if you wanted to say that argument and then give Ortiz credit for his career has gone long enough that he's still productive in a much less offensive era than Martinez or Thomas played in, because those two guys' careers basically were the most offensive era in baseball since the 1930s.
But when you say OPS plus, you're already normalizing for that.
Right, you're right. But if you want to give Edgar Martinez a little bit more credit, because when he did play defense, he played more third. I think that those three guys are the guys who are in the argument. But I think Frank Thomas was that argument.
The interesting thing to me, though, is that what's the most fascinating part of David Ortiz's career to me is that we're talking about a guy who looked like he was done.
Yeah, he was non-tendered for $1.25 million, but the Red Sox signed him for $1.25
million. No, I'm not talking about that point, Doug.
Oh, a couple of years ago.
I'm talking a couple of years ago where it really looked like, okay, this is a guy who can't get around on the good fastball anymore. The power's not what it was. And now, here he is, and really, he's as good as he's ever been right now.
He's close, that's for sure. I mean, you know, Hall of Famer, JJ? I mean, yeah. We don't have votes, but...
I think, again, take standard caveat applies. He's been tarred with the PED brush, which in modern day, it does seem like that means he's probably not going to get, you know, that there's a very good chance he's not going to get voted in.
It was 2009 that he had his 238, 332, 462 year. He still hit 28 home runs that year. And the year before, 2008, 23 home runs. Those were those two back-to-back years where he was mortal. So the last two seasons, the rate stats were great in 2012. But I don't know if he quit on the Red Sox or just decided, boy, that Achilles, I'm really going to not push it to come back to play for Bobby Valentine. You know, I mean, that's the better way to put it.
To me, by the way, that is another fascinating aspect of this, is that it's amazing. And I don't want to put it all on Bobby Valentine. I mean, like, I think it's fair to say Bobby Valentine will never get another managing job because of that.
He gone.
That's done. That being said, though, it is amazing to me, and I know they got the reset with the big trade with the Dodgers and all that, but that being said, it is fascinating to me that a team that could be the disaster that they were last year, I mean, you know, it's not your typical, they're not what I think of as a worst to first story.
And they weren't like, it wasn't like this year's Phillies, who were uninteresting and boring and won 73 games. They won 63 games, I think it was last year.
And really,
it was horrendous.
I know they had, in many ways, you know, they had a new outfield because Ellsbury was healthy, and then they had new corners,
including Daniel Nava.
But that being said, it is amazing to me that really, still, the core of this team, though, is the same core they had last year.
Yeah, it is the same core. I mean, the big differences were the guys around the edges, mm-hmm. Victorino, Napoli, those kind of guys.
And this is a team, though. You look at this team and say, okay, we saw, we're starting to see right now. We talked about with the Braves, okay, do they have new core guys stepping in? Well, one of them was playing third base. That's a core guy.
Xander Bogaerts was part of two pretty nice celebrations this year because there's this World Series championship and then the one when they beat Cuba in Taiwan.
He had a long season.
He did. And I just love reading. I'm putting the international section together for the Almanac, the granddaddy of them all. And rereading about Xander Bogaerts' role in their upset of Cuba, and then reading about him being the third baseman in San Francisco, where he was at third, Profar was at second, and Simmons was at short. It was a lot of fun to watch the Netherlands take infield. We'll just put it that way. That was a very fun way to start the baseball season for us with professionals.
And it really is kind of sad. Fun way to end it. You get to put a little exclamation point next week.
A little extra bow on it next week in the Arizona Fall League.
Oh, exclamation point, maybe a little strong when you say World Series is over.
But we weren't there for that.
Yeah.
A good period at the end of the season, like you said, for Arizona Fall League. And I actually very happy to be part of MLB Network's broadcast next week. So look forward to that. I'll be on four games next week, and I'll bring the headset and we'll try to Skype from there as well.
And I'll be using the Blue Yeti,
which is outstanding. Like I said, feel free to go review the audio quality at the very least on iTunes and let people know that, hey, we actually sound better than we used to sound. So for @JJCoop36, I'm @JohnManuelBA. We'll see you on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.
I kind of feel like that is your, when you get your prospect handbook, and we assume that if you listen to this, it's well worth your while to get one. When you get it, look at